Building high-functioning teams is considered both an art and a science. This week's guest, tech executive consultant Aviv Ben-Yosef, has built what he calls the Tech Executive Operating System. It guides leaders through their first 100 days at an organization and beyond.
This episode is sponsored by Linear B. Give your dev team the power to improve with team-based metrics, high-risk code alerts, and the world's first project board based on real-time Git activity. Sign up free at linearb.io.
Hey everyone, welcome to Dev Interrupted. I'm your host, Dan Lines, and today I'm joined by tech executive consultant and author, Aviv Ben-Yosef. Aviv, thanks so much for joining today.
Hey Dan, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know you have a new book out, and we're going to dive into that at one point. But before we get there, I'd love to let our audience get to know you a little bit better. And one thing that I know about you, like myself, we both started out as developers, as engineers, and now you're doing this executive consulting stuff. How did you get into tech executive consulting?
Oh, wow. So I started coding when I was 9, and I've been in love with code ever since then. And after several years of working at big corporates, being first employee at startups, and being a freelancer in a bunch of very successful startups for the past few years, after I think 4, 5, 6 years of doing this, I realized that I was this highly paid band-aid. A VP of engineering would bring me in to help them deliver really fast. And I would make the keyboard go clickety-clack really good. But the moment I moved along to the next client, I saw the previous ones going back to their old ways and old delivery rates. And I wanted to have a bigger of a dent on my clients. And that's when I started transitioning from really doing the work for them to helping them realize how to build these, I call these world-class engineering teams, or I talk about that's triple your impact per engineer, and that's what I'm trying to make happen for my clients. And it's been a slow transition over a few years, and now that's all I do.
Yeah, it's always sad if you're brought into a project and then that project goes really well and then you leave and it goes back to shit and it's just, I should have taught you how to fish. Then you could have done this yourself. So what type of companies, like team size and spaces, who are you working with? What types?
Oh, actually, I think that this is like the fact that when I do code, I love touching everything, like backend, frontend, mobile, whatever. If it's cool and if it has an impact, that's what turns me on. And the same applies to my clients. If they do interesting stuff, I want to help. Really, right now, I'm working with a startup that's 2 weeks old, and I'm working with some local Israeli unicorns, for example. So all the range.
Oh, that's awesome. So it's not really dependent on the size, but more so the type of person and the team and what they're looking to accomplish. When you go in and you start working with the executives, the tech executives, is there any common troubles that they're having, or what are you seeing out there in the world right now?
There are a few things that I would say. As a consultant, most of the times people think of you because the shit has hit the fan and they need help. They need something to be recovered. And that's often stuff like, my team is not delivering as it used to, or, oh my God, we've tripled the team size, but we're barely delivering at the same rate we used to like a year ago.
Yeah.
Or I hear CEOs coming to me and telling me stuff like, they said that this feature is 6 months. It should take 2 months, in my opinion. What are we supposed to be doing about this? That sort of stuff.
I hate hearing that.
Frankly, as a consultant, when I hear those, that's the easy stuff, because like the same applies to code. You hear someone talk about a bug that they see and you've already saw that bug 20 times in the past year. You can already tell them, oh, you need to look at the third parameter of that function and you just need to change it probably. And these are the easy cases. For me, the real challenges, and that's what I love doing more than anything nowadays, is when someone comes up to me and says, we're gonna triple the team size. We're doing great now, but I want to ensure that we do great in a year or even better. And that's the real innovation for me. That's when we have to think about how do we make a great team even better and not just me coming over and pointing at, oh, you're not handling that. Oh, you need to be taking care of your personal growth for your people better, stuff like that. That's the easy game for me.
Yeah, that's something that I'm going to want to touch on here. It's also one of the worst feelings when either you're scaling or you're going to scale, you're tripling your engineering size, but your output is not triple or more. I've actually been in that situation. That's not a fun situation to be in. That's something that I'm going to want to dive into you with you about. But also, just to finish the context about you, you also have a podcast and you have a newsletter, the Change Catalyst newsletter. Can you tell us a little bit about those two things?
Sure. So I have my weekly podcast, the Tech Exec Podcast. And I think that by the time this is released, I will be celebrating 100 episodes. It's a weekly short tidbit, like 7 to 10 minutes long most of times. And just me sharing some, I'm trying to share some provocative thoughts that if you listen to in the middle of all of those podcasts you're listening to, my goal is to be that podcast that makes you stop and write down an idea. So that's that. And my newsletter is essentially every week it shares the podcast, my weekly article, and 3 exclusive insights that I usually don't share anywhere else. And frankly, for me, it's an outlet for disclosing the most interesting thoughts and the most provocative ones with a closer audience before I see that it's safe enough to share it with the outside world.
Great. I found one particular podcast to be very interesting. You were talking about your experience as a software engineer. You were in the Israeli Defense Force. You're in a situation where some engineers weren't necessarily great at their jobs, but could not be let go for a bunch of different circumstances. You also pointed out that there are a lot of military leaders who struggled to change their teams. You talk a little bit about the lip service of, hey, we're a family. That could be part of the reason. What would you say to leaders who know some of their team or teammates are lagging, but are having trouble making the decision to make a change?
I would say that if you've accepted the role of a leader, then no matter how hard it is, you are doing your team a disservice if you don't provide that candid feedback, if you don't do what needs to be done to help people. And frankly, I really, truly, genuinely believe that if you have someone that's not a good match for the team, you will be doing that person a favor as well when you come and tell it to them in their face. You don't have to be, if you recall the old show, House MD or something like that, with you, Laura, you don't have to go and try and insult people.
Yeah. But you don't have to be a dick.
Exactly. But you don't have to do that, but you do need to be frank and tell them, have you noticed that the past couple of months, you haven't been on top of your game, stuff like that. And when you do that, sometimes someone might leave or you might decide to let them go. But I've seen a bunch of times when someone moves on to a new team or a new company and thrive over there. Because sometimes just the circumstances over here at this specific point in time and this specific team doesn't work, but they can just move along and become better. And I genuinely believe that. So you need to start thinking with that mindset and man up or person up.
Yeah, I found that throughout my whole career. It's always tough to give someone straightforward or negative feedback. And it's even tougher when, hey, there's an engineer on my team or a manager on my team that I know should not be here, but going through the whole process of letting them go and the reaction, and then you have to find someone new, that's a huge weight on your head. But every time that I've done that in my career, like you say, it has always worked out not only better for me, and my team, doing a service to my team by doing that. But also, typically, that person is able to find a better situation for themselves, a culture, maybe learning opportunities. It usually works better for them as well. So pulling the trigger at the right time on that, making the change, has always been, honestly, more positive than negative for me.
Yeah, and it applies on all levels of the organization, not just for an IC. About a year ago, I was working with a company, and eventually I think it was a mutual decision that the CTO isn't a good fit and should leave. Fast forward a year, the team is now like three times the size and doing great. And that CTO is now a co-founder of a new startup, and he's having fun as well. It's a win-win situation.
Right. We previously had Catherine Kohler. So she's the head of productivity engineering at Netflix. She came on the podcast and she said something, and you probably know Netflix has a really good engineering culture. She said something pretty explicit that resonated with me. They have a motto or a quote that's, "We're not a family, we're a team of high performers." Sometimes you get into the situation of a company that says, "Hey, we're just a family," which then makes you think, "Oh, okay, you can't do anything wrong to your family or let someone go." And they have a very straightforward mindset. We're not a family, we're a team of high performers. Do you have any recommendation for engineering leaders how to keep the team stable and focused, but while also enabling turnover to happen when necessary?
Yeah. First of all, I would say that some turnover is good. Just like you can't be president of the United States for more than 8 years, right? Two terms, and then you move along, because some transition, some new blood is always good. And I saw companies take it to an extreme where they had these, I call them org chart patches, that there's someone with a special title and a special responsibility, just so that single person won't leave the company. And that person has to be invited to those kinds of meetings, or they have a team that's not doing anything that's on the roadmap, just because we want to have that person remain in the company. And I believe that's a big lose for the entire company, because what we are teaching people, what they are reading between the lines, is that it doesn't really matter if you do something special or important right now, as long as you have some knowledge that we value, stuff like that. I think that, first of all, you have to be okay with some people leaving. Does that mean that you shouldn't be trying to retain good people? Of course not. But it does mean that when you see that someone really wants to leave, or the price is higher than you're willing to pay, and I'm not talking about actual dollars, I'm talking about the cost for the entire organization to retain that person, let them go. And for executives, when I'm working with them, I always say you have to account for churn when you're planning the growth of your team, so that when people eventually leave, you are not, you know, left there without enough people already in place. So start with thinking about it two steps ahead, and then you can actually win in this game. And also, when you're retaining people, I believe in doing it from the right set challenges and motivations for those people. There's a big issue, I believe, with that standard in our industry. We just provide people, we throw option grants at them so they stay for 4 more years and 4 more years.
But yeah, golden handcuffs.
Yep. Exactly. And would you like someone to stay in the company for 3 more years because they have options that they are still vesting? Just imagine being a teammate of a person who's in this for years just because of that. I hate that. And it pains me in my gut. Really, it's something that I really think is an issue in our industry, where people are wasting away years doing something they don't like just in order to get some options that might not be even worth anything. So I believe that we need to make people stay because they are motivated, because you challenge them, because they see incredible personal growth, because they achieve self-actualization. If you have the Maslow hierarchy of needs, self-actualization, I feel like all of my potential is being put to use. And that's what I'm trying to help my clients create.
Yeah, so some great advice there. And you could almost say that there's such thing as maybe we call it like positive churn. And if you're planning exactly. for that positive churn, some people will leave for the right reasons. And as an engineering leader, you can be in better shape. I think it's the company Zappos. There's some like really innovative company that I read about that does a thing where they say, we're going to give you $5,000 if you want to leave. We'll pay you to leave. And the mindset there is if there's people in the company that aren't feeling self-fulfilled and they know maybe they want to leave, but finding a job is scary. I have kids at home. I can't make that change. Hey, we're going to give mm-hmm. you some money to leave. And therefore, we're going to retain the people that need to be here and we're going to bring in the new blood. Yeah. That's a little bit more out there and extreme, but I found that to be very interesting.
Yeah, I love that idea.
Yeah, the other part of this whole thing that we know is that hiring and enabling onboarding is super important and always challenging for tech leaders. Hey, Dev Interrupted community. On August 11th, I'll be joined by four leaders of remote work. Darren Murph, GitLab's Global Head of Remote. Lawrence Mandel, Director of Engineering at Shopify. Shweta Serif, Senior Director of Engineering at Equinix. And Chris Downard, VP of Engineering at GigSmart. They're coming on for a live stream panel to share their insights and perspectives on the future of remote work, and also how to successfully hire, onboard, and work remotely. This event is free, and I'll include a link in the show notes. I hope to see you all there. Do you have any tips for our leaders around hiring process, new talent, that type of thing?
When it comes to hiring, I tend to look at it as I want to ensure that each and every step that we have has a goal. So, for example, when I do this hiring process debugging with my clients, I say, let's look at the funnel. How many no's are we getting per step along the way? If we are going through some technical interview and I see that essentially no one is ever rejected to do it, or pretty much everyone is rejected due to it, I know that we have an issue here. And too many people don't think about it. Don't take the time to say, all right, if we're spending the time, the team's time and the time of the interviewees, it should do something. It should have a meaning. So start with that. And all of a sudden you can see a bunch of useless interviews be deleted from your calendar, which is always good. But also I see it as an opportunity to allow a lot of your team to participate. And that also means that you can take the load off from just having your managers and senior people be in those interviews. I really believe that, first of all, it makes the interviewees see who they're going to work with, not just managers, but also you provide all sorts of people and ICs in the company the ability to do something that's, I think, very rewarding, very challenging. First of all, there's that. Now, when we're talking about onboarding is an entirely different problem. And one thing that I've been experimenting with my different clients lately is the concept of onboarding people to this cocoon where you are being brought into a team and all of the only purpose of that team is to allow you to learn rapidly, no matter what background you came with. Maybe you're even slated to be an engineering manager in a month. You still are brought in and you learn the actual product. I call it product mastery. I want to make sure that people don't just understand the tech and the specific feature or module subsystem that they're going to work on. I want to make sure that they understand the product, the users. Why are our customers using it? What is the competition doing? That sort of stuff so that they understand the product and not just the tech. And then when they are given roadmaps, when they hear about features, they know exactly where to poke and prod and say, maybe that doesn't make a lot of sense because it takes 2 weeks and no one's going to use it. That sort of stuff. I want to see those discussions, and you can only get it if at onboarding, and you need to maintain the knowledge, but at least when onboarding, you want to have them go through this product mastery one-on-one thing.
Actually, that makes a lot of sense to me, because what I've seen at, you know, some of my jobs and some companies is that mastery only comes after many years. So I've been at the company for, I'm a developer, maybe like a year or two, and now I feel confident poking and questioning like, hey, would our customers really use this way? So I love your idea of giving that type of confidence and knowledge up front. Then I can be more productive. I think that's the name of the game, right?
Yeah. I actually call it sometimes experience acceleration or an experience pressure cooker. I want to make sure that you learn as rapidly as you can learn, because I believe people can. You talked earlier about my service. I was 18 years old and I was working on systems that are life critical, mission critical. If there's a bug, we might be missing out intelligence saying that there's a terror attack about to happen, yeah, which happens from time to time in Israel. And many people can't even imagine taking an 18-year-old fresh out of high school with no real world experience and having that person be in charge of something like that. But you can do it if you take motivated people and you provide them with the autonomy, with the agency and ownership to take charge. And I've seen it happen. And that's why I believe if I could do it when I was 18, it's not because I'm this genius, but because I was given the right culture and mindset. I believe that we can do it with people who are 10 years in the industry, but only a month into their current role in your company.
Absolutely. I want to switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about your book. So you have a book, it's called The Tech Executive Operating System, Creating an R&D Organization That Moves the Needle. Can you give us a quick overview and intro of the book, why you made it, how it came to be? What do I get out of this book?
I think as with most books, I realized that I had the book within me. I noticed that I was using the same approaches, saying the same stuff to my clients over and over again. And since I cannot work with all different tech execs in the universe, I said, all right, let's see how can I share it with more people. And COVID came along, obliterated my commuting time. And I said, all right, let's put that time to good use. And I just wrote the book. And what you get out of it is a set of thought systems, some short algorithms, I call them, how to scrub your calendar every once in a while, how to design your first 100 days in a new role as a tech executive or as a senior leader, that sort of stuff. And I've collected all of those. And my intention is that after you read it, it's not like Neo, if you've seen The Matrix, you wake Absolutely. Up and you say, I know Kung Fu. That's not what's going to happen from a
book. I can't just download the book into my brain and know everything.
Sorry. That's not the way it works. But what I do believe that it does is like the first time I read Design Patterns, and all of a sudden I could see patterns in code I already knew. I had names for that sort of stuff. I'm trying to provide you with that same sort of understanding for being in a tech leadership role, and also make you more aware of your unknowns, what you now have transitioned from unknown unknowns to known unknowns. So you know where to focus, where to be more cautious, that sort of stuff.
You mentioned there's an area in the book about your first 100 days as a leader. I assume it's you could be a new leader, your first time ever being a leader, but also I've joined an organization and here, new organization, here's my first 100 exactly. days. I'm really interested in that. Tell me things that I should do in my first 100 days.
I have a few suggestions. And first of all, I talk about gaining executive product mastery, which is you have to understand the product, especially when you're joining a team that's already running, that already has a product that customers are using. You have to understand the business model, the finances. How is this thing working, or how are we aiming for it to work? You have to have, I say, friction with real life customers. So see recordings of sales calls, see what people are saying. If you are doing B2B, go and see how the installations are being done. If you're doing B2C, I want to see you spend hours on Twitter or Reddit or whatever and see what people are saying about the product, because you have to understand the world you're operating within. That's one thing. Another thing is I'm helping my clients. I call it clear the fog of war. Like when you start a new StarCraft game and the map is essentially fog and you have to go someplace to see what's in there. So I provide you with a list of things that you need to check out because you can never know what's going to be uncovered. Like talking to your peers, the chief of marketing, the chief of sales, talking to them, seeing what's on their minds, what they've been thinking about. See what customer success are doing. All of these stuff that's essentially helping you map out what's going on. And then you also have to start forming your plan for what are we going to do? Because I always say that there are certain points in time where doing something different is easier. So when you join a team, you have this, I call it the window of malleability, where people are more open to changes because they expect you to change something. You're a new executive. As it might sound like a cliche, but people expect it. So it is often better to start testing things out earlier rather than later.
It's like you have a grace period to try new things.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And when someone joins your team, I would say don't wait till 3 months in and then provide them with feedback about how they've been doing, because 3 months in, that's it. They're integrated. They have been ingrained with whatever they've been doing in the past 3 months. I want to make sure that I provide them with feedback a month into it. So the same applies when I'm designing my team and designing the scope of the changes I'm going to be making soon, stuff like that. And lastly, I always say that you need to ensure that you are not merely an order taker kind of executive. A lot of times, people who I work with, tech execs, are really good at the tech part, not as good in the exec part when it comes to the mindset, because we're used to just getting a roadmap and executing on it. But I say, no, you need to be there when that roadmap is being formed. You need to be aware of it as it is being formed, and you need to help shape it so that when there comes a time that the team is executing on it, you have the entire context and you've helped make it fit what your team is capable of doing. I call it moving upstream. And that is something that you have to do. And as an executive, you should start doing it as soon as you're bought into your new role.
Yeah, there's two things that come to mind for me. What you were saying resonates a lot. One thing I would double down on is I do see a tendency for engineering executives compared to a sales executive or a marketing executive. They come in and they don't fully understand the business, or they don't seek out, how do I understand? How does sales work? How does retention work? What do the users really, you know, do with the product? What's our game plan to 5x revenue? And if you don't do that, it's harder to get a true seat or opinion at the executive table, because your peers are going to look at you as, well, you're just the product roadmap executor. You're the highest position in engineering and we do respect you, but you're the executor. That doesn't feel good. That's not a good place to be in. It will be harder to impact the product roadmap if your peers don't know that you actually understand everything about the business just as well as you do. So I wanted to double down on that. The other thing that I wanted to get your opinion on, one thing that I've done that has worked for me, is I'm usually looking for leverage points. If I'm coming into a new team, I'm asking myself, if I do want to make a change, which you usually do want to make a change, what are those leverage points that would cause the highest impact for my engineers? Is it something in, I'll get very tactical, is it something in our pull request process that if I saw I could improve this, the 100 engineers below me, all of them would see an improvement? Is it our deployment process or our automated testing process where, again, if I push to make this change, I have 100 people that instantaneously are able to do their work faster? So that's those leverage points and seeking them out is something that worked well for me. Is that something that resonates with you, Aviv?
Oh boy. First of all, I talk a bunch about force multipliers. I want to see where I can as myself, become a force multiplier in the company, and also where I can coach people along the way to become force multipliers by themselves. But also what you talked about is something I call tech capital. I'm saying let's stop obsessing over tech debt, because there's a limit to how low you can get your debt. And let's think about tech capital. What can we do that then enables new stuff? And tech capital isn't a new feature. It's actual stuff that makes things better from here to eternity. As you said, fixing something in the pull request process that now makes, even if it saves a minute for every engineer in the company every day, that's a lot. Or my favorite types of tech capital are capital where you help other parts of the organization. And that's when, as you said, knowing what marketing is doing is incredibly useful, because you can actually help them. I call this coders without borders, which means how can my engineers do something that no one put on the roadmap? No one's going to say, you know, create a tool for our marketing team to be able to do some of the work faster, because we're thinking about the product, right? The product people who put stuff on the roadmap with you are thinking about the actual product. But can we make marketing 10 times faster because someone spent a week doing something with a no-code or low-code tool and a bit of coding that now enables them to run A/B tests faster, to change emails without having to talk to engineers, to validate the pipeline given some open source data that allows you to see, you take an open data set and you've helped marketing see which kind of leads are more interesting than others. I've seen those implemented with clients and it makes a huge difference. And once you have that ability, that this option exists, I can create stuff that's not solely for product, for the users, then you understand you can have a huge impact within your company. So that's a bunch of leverage that you can have.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love that, coders without borders. And that's something that can only happen more organically. Like you say, that's never going to be on the roadmap. That only happens if you have a strategic awareness of what's going on at the company. It's the only way. Now, I believe it's chapter 5 of your book. You start to get into the executive tool set that makes this operating system work. Can you talk about the crucial tools or skills in that framework?
Yeah. First of all, I start in that chapter with the mindsets that you need to have, because I think those are even more important. For example, one of them is, I call it the executive mindset. And it's a bit like, if you've ever read anything about Steve Jobs, he was described as having this force field. He would come into the room and make you think, oh, that's possible, right? No matter what it is. And I want executives to have that same sort of sense. They need to be a lighthouse that's radiating optimism and can do to the team. As techies, especially senior techies, what we've been ingrained to do is to be cynical and be pessimistic, because that works great when you have to create a whole new system, when you have to decide if something is going to be risky for the next quarter. But when you transition from being the executor to the one that's supposed to provide the team with that right spirit, with that optimism, you need to think can do. You need to think, how can I make them believe it? My example usually is, if I provide you with a chessboard, with a given position, just say, hey, Dan, what are you going to do? You're going to think for a couple of minutes. And unless you're really good at chess, you're going to say, I don't know, move that pawn. But if I give you the same chessboard and say, hey, Dan, white to move, mate in two, you're going to spend 5 minutes and you're going to tell me how to get that mate in two. If I tell you that there's a solution, that it's possible, without even telling you what is the solution, you're going to think harder. I want executives to do that. That's the executive mindset. Another example is not shying away, which is exactly what we talked about earlier. You can't shy away from providing code. You can't shy away from providing feedback. You have to tell people when they're not performing. You have to tell people what you're actually thinking. And lastly, another mindset that I like is that you have to learn to let go. Whatever worked for you when you were an amazing coder won't work for you when you're a manager, won't work when you're managing managers, and what won't work when you're an executive. You have to keep growing. I can't use the same programming languages or the same frameworks I used when I learned to code when I was 9, because no one wants production code in Pascal. And the same applies for manager roles. We have to keep growing and changing and adapting with the organization.
Yeah, I can totally relate. I wrote a blog and did some talks about moving from being an individual developer to a manager and then a director and a VP, and you're totally right. The things that made you a great developer will not make you a great executive. So you have to be free and be able to move on and accept that you're not hands-on in the code and Superman, I'm going to come in and fix everything myself, all of that. Aviv, thanks so much for taking the time to tell us more about your work, your new book, and all of the insights that you've provided for engineering leaders and engineering organizations.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time.
Of course. So if listeners want to connect with you on your consulting work or learn more about your book, where can they go?
They can get a free sample chapter, which is about the innovation part I talked about, on techexecutiveoperatingsystem.com. And if you want to reach out and talk to me, you can just ping me. My email is on my website, avivbenyosef.com. There's also a link to the newsletter and podcast and everything else over there, but I'm always happy to talk to leaders about what they are going through.
All right, everyone, make sure you check out everything that Aviv has just said there. Also, be sure to join the Dev Interrupted Discord community where we keep this conversation going all week long. If you haven't already reviewed the show on Apple Podcasts, please take 60 seconds. Apple Podcast reviews are a really important way that our show guests get discovered. Everything that we've discussed, including Aviv's new book, is available in the links in the description below. Aviv, thank you again. It's been awesome.
Thank you.